Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Robert?
Today, Russell, I am feeling rude.
Oof.
And I don't mean rude necessarily in the way that we all think about it. I'm actually thinking about it in terms of how today's guest describes their work and the way that they will make work to interrupt and exist in between. And there's this concept of rudeness, which I am totally obsessed with. Mm. And you, actually, Russell Tovey, mm-hmm. were the person that first introduced me to today's guest work, because you, maybe inadvertently, but you took me to South London Gallery mm-hmm. for the New Contemporaries mm-hmm. a few years ago. Maybe it was like 2020 or something. Mm-hmm. And to see whose work was it? Jake Rule's work
was there, yeah.
Yeah, because you were friends with Jake. And we went down to see it. And then we went across the road into the fire station building. And I remember seeing this film. And I was finding it really overwhelming that day. I don't know if I was stressed out. I don't know what was going on.
That's but not for some like reason, you.
I know, you know what I'm like. Such a drama queen.
Rude. Yes,
and rude, yes, that's very what I am. Anyway, I walked into this room, saw this film, and it totally blew my mind. And it also really, it created through the movement within the film a kind of stillness within me and calmed me down. And I just focused on this film and the voice and the movements and this kind of slowed down dance. And I remember then later hearing about this artist via Arcadia Missa Gallery mm. because I think they'd started working very young in the career of this artist. And then Lindsay Mendick mentioned them, and so many people just kept mentioning this artist to me to the point where they ended up in my house at a party because they did a solo show, which was extraordinarily beautiful, at Quench Gallery, which is run by Lindsay Mendick and Guy Oliver. So anyway, since then they've shown at the SLG. They're about to open an incredible body of
SLG for people.
Oh, sorry, the South London Gallery,
yes.
in Peckham, which
yes.
we love.
Love.
Big shout out to Margot Heller. But they're about to open a new show, a brand new body of work in Bristol at the Martin Parr Foundation. And we're going to be exploring that today. But they've also, in February, it was announced their work was entering the Tate Collections. There are so many places you can experience and see their work. So we are thrilled and very, very proud to welcome to Talk Art the one and only Reenie Matic. Hi, Reenie.
Hi, thank you for having me. This is amazing. It is a celebration of me. Wow.
It's all about you, Reenie.
That's exactly how I want it.
How it's going to be. Where are you in the world right now?
I am in Dalston in my flat. And I have two dogs around me and a partner in the other room. So sorry if there's ever any noise. But
who's loudest, the dogs or the partner?
Depends what situation we're in.
Oh, okay. Aren't we going there, right, already?
So on that note, actually, can we discuss the rudeness idea? So the way, because it's actually in your bio even.
It's like, in your manifesto.
It's your manifesto, precisely that. So can we start there?
I really like it when people remind me of it, because it's something that I kind of forget about when I'm working. Then I'm like, no, don't forget about that thing. Come back to it in every piece of work, every piece of research that I'm doing. But yeah, I guess rudeness came from the rude boy, which is kind of like what the skinheads were inspired by. My dad identifies as a rude boy, and therefore I do as well. Yeah, so I realized that this idea of rudeness could be a really powerful tool in a similar way to Legacy Russell's glitch feminism, but I guess outside of the internet, in like, I don't know, what Legacy Russell says AFK, as in away from keyboard, instead of IRL, because obviously it's all real life anyway. But yeah, this idea of rudeness as an amazing space to exist in, especially as somebody who is mixed race and therefore in between all of these different identities, I suppose, it's rude. It's immediately rude to be me, whether I like it or not. So it's kind of more of an embracing of that. And yeah, I talk about it as in an interruption or an existence in between. And I always loved thinking about my mum. It's a word that my mum used a lot when we were younger, like, don't be rude, as in when we were interrupting, or it was the way that we were taught not to be. We're always taught not to be that. And obviously there's a lot of parts of my identity that I'm taught not to be or not to show. So it's more of an embracing of fucking it up a little bit. And yeah, I've got it tattooed on my arm, and my nephew is called Rudy, and it's like a full body experience, you know.
Why would you say, for people listening, your existence is rude then? Why just to be you is rude?
I think that because most and every part of me is a kind of queering of white supremacist heteropatriarchy, as bell hooks puts it. Like, you know, I'm queer, I'm non-binary, I'm mixed race, I'm like the hashtag future liberals want. So I decided to not find a place for me to sit, because there isn't really one anyway. I'm not afforded that. So wherever I am, there's a sense of interruption. There's a sense of drawing attention to the fact that, or the world is going, is moving in a place where most people don't want it. Not most people, but, you know, I guess like hegemony and like, you know, the status quo don't really want it to move to. So here I am. I always say, like, all I had to do was breathe, you know, all I had to do was be born to be rude. You know, I don't want to try very hard.
You know, in the past decade, there's been this, especially in the kind of left way of thinking in the world, there's been a lot of growth and a lot of education and development of feminism as well, in terms of like thinking about loads of different people's experiences and how they all intersect. Mm-hmm. But I feel like your work has actually really helped to educate me on quite a profound number of levels. And starting off with that film that I saw, you know, when you were still a student, essentially, it was like you're kind of your post-student show, isn't it? It's like can you explain what the New Contemporaries is, actually, for people listening?
Yeah, I mean, New Contemporaries is kind of, I guess, you enter into it. So you do like a proposal for a work that you feel is worthy, and then they either show it or they don't. But I guess I'm probably not the best person to describe what New is, to be fair.
Anyway, it's something that if you're a young artist, definitely look into, because it's a great platform in terms of getting your work seen. And and it's been going on for decades. It's
and amazing artists have been shown there and have started off there. So it was a real honor. And yeah, I think it was 2020. So I'd graduated that year, or like, I don't know, in quotation marks, graduated, because I graduated in lockdown.
Central St. Martin's, right?
Yeah, from Central St. Martin's. I studied fine art. And so that film was called Brown Girl in the Art World 3. And I had made that in my second year at uni. And I was really interested in these single shot, slow motion moments of me dancing, because I was interested in fighting and dancing as a similar language. And I was looking at that, and I noticed that a lot of fight scenes in films are often slowed down so that you can see every single movement and every single kind of conversation that's going on with the bodies that are on screen. So that's why all of those, I've made a few of those films in that way. And so that's why they're always slowed down. But I wanted to give people a chance to really look at a body moving. I suppose that when you slow something down, it reaches a point of abstraction, but it's also complete clarity at the same time. So it has this dichotomy of everything that I explore anyway, this rudeness, this at once inside and outside of everything. And so that film I had had for a while, because I had driven, as I speak about it in the film, that I'd come across this pub when I was on a drive with my ex-partner and their family, and it was just there, and it said lease this pub, and it had these St. George's crosses outside, and I was like, this is a stage, I have to dance immediately here. So I did that, but then I was tussling around with what audio or what people needed to hear and see. I guess like it's important for me to play on all of the senses in a lot of my work. So it took me a while to figure it out. And then I had to go to uni to do a talk about my year in, you know, work and how what I'd discovered. And I decided to use this film as the visual, and the audio then became the talk that I did at uni.
Did you always find communicating easy in terms of like talking? Because I was just blown away when I saw that video and heard your voice, because the way you speak was so clear. And I know that it's obviously come from an educational situation of maybe like a crit or a discussion like that, where you have to be quite accurate and on it and explaining, almost like defending your work actually. But is language something that always came easy to you, like expressing yourself like that?
I wouldn't say so, no. I've never ever been an academic person at all. I've never been able to read very well either. I've not diagnosed dyslexic, but my mum's pretty sure from when I was born that was what was going on. But I think that's why art came first for me, because that's the way that I suppose, articulated myself. But then I quickly realised that I didn't have to articulate myself very clearly through learning how to read more and reading things that didn't quite make sense. But I suppose poetry, you know, things that are not linear, I found a voice through that. And even though I would say that I am quite articulate in that audio, I think that it has something to do with also what the piece is about, because the piece is about what it means to image a black body and the demands of, I said then that I was a femme, but that's up for discussion now, gender-wise, but you know, what it meant then to image a black femme queer body and wanting to film myself dancing, but that not being simple because of the gaze and all of the politics that go into looking at this body. But at the same time, the fact that I had to articulate myself that well to an audience is part of that as well, because I don't like to articulate myself very well. I don't know how. I don't need to. That's why I'm an artist. You know, I wouldn't, if I knew how to articulate myself, I don't think I would be an artist, because being an artist means that an artist practice to me is a continuous exploration and question asking and answering, and it never really ends. And I don't really ever know what's going on properly. So I think that I'm glad that you think that I can articulate myself well.
I think what you're saying is that when words aren't enough, that's where the art starts. But then also now you have to, words aren't enough, so you make the art, but now you have to talk about the art that words weren't enough for. So that's it's quite hard. So this pub, Lisa's pub, that had these George crosses outside, what was it about that made you feel compelled to move in front of? Why was it the gaze from this particular pub and this absolute Britishness? What is it about that?
I'm just very drawn to it as what's the word? A contradiction. I think that's what I'm talking about when I say rudeness as well. You know, I am a contradiction to a lot of the narratives that surround Britishness and nationalism and, you know, fascism. And this pub as an image gives everything that I am not and yet I am, because that's my culture. Pub, a working class pub culture with, you know, with celebrations of Britishness is something that I've grown up around. And yet to have my body in that space doesn't quite look the way that people would expect that kind of celebration to look, I suppose. And, you know, I'm not saying that I celebrate that, but I celebrate the fact that I can, contradict all of the narratives surrounding what being British should be, I suppose.
And there's an amazing part where a woman from inside the pub, it seems, appears in the right-hand corner.
Yeah.
So you've got this kind of representation of the white gaze,
as
well as your ex-partner who was actually filming it and apparently speaking and directing you almost to encourage you, because that day you were knackered.
And
I think you described yourself as being sort of like lazy or something.
Yeah, I was
like
being
that.
Lazy because surrounding me is this gaze already within within the physical space that I'm in, and then also, you know, whoever is looking at the film. So yes, the person who comes and looks at me is really interesting, because it gives that exact moment of, you can see her thinking, what is this person doing? Why are they here? Do I need to do something about it? And you know, that is what
rude. You're being rude. Is she being rude? Is she taking the piss? Are they being rude? Are they taking the piss?
Russ, don't worry.
Okay. That's what that woman would have been thinking.
Yeah, exactly. You can see the kind of cogs turning already. And the most amazing thing is that I'm not interrupted. Thank God. Although I guess I am, because I'm my image being me and the surrounding, she comes into it and then leaves. And it's like, you know, that's, there's lots of parts to that work that I think I would like to explore further. Obviously, when you make a work, when you're, I don't know how old I was, 22, 21, you don't, you know, when I make any work, I literally have no idea what's going on until it's up and it's out and people are looking at it, and or it's like years after, and you know, so that work still continues to give me something. And yeah, I've been past that pub recently and it didn't have the St. George's crosses and it looked completely different. So it was like, you know, that moment is really exists in that film.
I really liked that though, because I heard you sort of deliberately were like, we have to stop, we have to do this now, because you recognized that might not, that those flags won't be there for much longer or whatever. It won't be that moment. And I loved the kind of, you know, when you're an artist and you're beginning to make your work, how it's all consuming and how it really is every single thing you think about every minute of every day. And that's what I thought it represented for me. The fact that you're looking for that stage, you're looking for that location all the time.
Constantly, yeah. And I think it's looking for me as well. And that's why the lease this pub was, you know, it was
an invitation.
It was an invitation, exactly. But what you say about, the immediacy of it, I'm really interested in these ideas of, especially in queerness, spaces that we inhabit that kind of don't exist unless we're there. You know, a dance floor, for instance, or, I mean, I guess any, it's like, if a tree falls in the wood and you're not there to hear it, or whatever the fuck that saying is.
Activate a space by you being present, that space becomes activated by your body.
Absolutely. That's a very generous thing to do, I think. I think that's something that we don't recognise that often, is that queerness and blackness being present in a space is very generous, because there's a violence to being outside of safety. And you know, that's, I'm immediately, you know, unsafe when I'm in that car park. But it's something about the framing of it that gives, I don't know, it gives that, I give the safety back to myself because I'm making something from it, I suppose.
Did you feel unsafe making it? Was that part of the energy?
And I think that it's not necessarily an unsafeness, but I have a huge anxiety when making. I only ever really make work by myself. Like I did for the film for South London Gallery of my dad, I shot that all by myself and I only had my partner with me at the time, because I just can't work if there's eyes or like energy, and especially white eyes and white energy around me. And obviously I had my ex-partner's mum, granny and them with me, and that's why I wasn't performing to the way that I would perform, say, if I was by myself. So if I'm in a living room, I'm dancing, I can give it energy, energy, energy. Or if I'm in a club, I suppose I can give energy, energy. But then it was not coming out of me, because there's a knowing that, you know, a kind of, maybe an unsafeness. I don't know.
You can't be unguarded in the moments.
Yeah, there is a protection of the self that is constantly present. And so that's why, I talk about it in the film, that my partner was saying, really, you need to get this shot, and you're not doing it in the way that you want to do it. And that's because I couldn't perform in the way I wanted to perform, but we got the most out of it.
So we talked about this manifesto and rudeness comes up, but something really beautiful in there, which I've really connected to, is the fact that you see the privileges in queer intimacies, partnerships and pleasures, the fact that you see that the privilege of that, or there's, I think you said in a chat with Emma Dabry, who we love, you feel so privileged in my unprivilegedness.
Absolutely.
And I adore that, because I've recently been thinking about what it is to be queer and always being told that the one in 10 seen as a negative. And lately I've started thinking, well, hang on a minute, if I'm the one in 10, then that makes me special, doesn't it? Doesn't it means I've been chosen.
Yeah.
10 beige, normal, like, existences. And I've been picked to have, like, a different existence for everyone else. So that means I'm the lucky one, doesn't
exactly,
it? And
yeah.
Spinning that, and I'm really connected to you finding the privileges.
You know, it's like in that new Beyonce song where it says there's a sound bite where she's used somebody's voice from history, I think, like a queer man probably. Mm-hmm. And it goes beige, fluorescent beige.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's what you are, Russ. You're fluorescent beige.
Neon beige.
The guy that I'm dating right now, he actually said that's his favourite line of anything
Absolutely.
He's heard in years. Fluorescent beige.
That is honestly one of the most incredible lines, because my mum growing up struggled with us identifying as Black, which is something in and of itself that is like a whole
never
thing.
Let you call yourself Black, right?
No, exactly. And you know, there's something to be said. I speak about it a lot in the Emma Dabry in conversation at South London Gallery, but to be called fluorescent beige, so we would call ourselves beige because that's what she preferred. She felt like by saying that we were beige, it involved her in our existence, which is
as a white mother
exactly. Yeah. And you know, I have a lot of empathy, a lot of rage, but a lot of empathy for what that means from her. And to be called fluorescent beige is like, there we go, you know. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, James Baldwin says something like, those who do not suffer cannot grow up. And it is a privilege to have, you know, I don't want to romanticize oppression in any kind of way, but it's, you know, we've got to deal with what we've got. And I want to be a happy person in this world, and I want to grow up. I don't want to be stunted. I have had periods of time in my life where things have felt impossible, that I couldn't be outside, and I couldn't imagine myself outside of the situation that I'm in. Bell Hooks talks about that, which I'm obsessed with, imagining the self outside of the situation you're in. That is survival, that is how we've moved things forward, and that is growing up, and I'm learning that a lot every day.
Do you think as queer people we have to grow up quicker than other people?
I would say so, yeah. I think in some ways. But then, you know, there's also moments where I look around and I'm like, we haven't grown. And also there's like...
We're all Peter Pan, aren't we?
Yeah, but yeah, we grow up, which is gorgeous. And, you know, at Trans Pride yesterday, in London Trans Pride, I could see all of these different, very childlike energies from everybody. And that is where we should be almost moving towards, I suppose. There's a seriousness in queerness that I am, it's important, but it doesn't serve us at all times. Like, who does that serve, actually? And I was speaking to Ajamu X recently, the photographer, about how when queerness was, this is his words, when queerness moves into academia, it became sanitized. And I can't stop thinking about that, because I'm like, it's true. There's a lacking in like naivety. It's like we have to have everything figured out and everything has to be squeaky clean.
You can't be rude anymore.
Can't be.
And this is Ajamu, who's the patron saint of dark rooms.
Exactly.
You know, he's saying this.
It's yes.
That is the ultimate rudeness. That is
exactly.
Like.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you know, that to me was like, wow, you're so right. I've been trying to find the words for what like tension I have, and I want it to be dirtier, as it should be.
Yeah, because it kind of takes the life out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow it becomes lifeless and it becomes joyless.
Yeah.
And it becomes sexless, actually. Almost like it takes it. Yeah,
of course Ajamu was talking about it with that lens, but like, it is, if something is fixed, it doesn't grow, it does not grow up. Like, that's where, you know, it needs to be limitless. It needs to be, yeah, allowed to be dirty and a bit rude.
Yeah, there's another line in, I think, in maybe in that first film in one of your films, I think, mm-hmm. where it says something about being having the agency or power to be yourself will lead to liberation.
Yeah.
Is that your work? It is your work.
Yeah, that is mine. That was, I think it was me quoting Janet.
Janet Mock.
Yeah. I can't remember what the quote is, but yes, it will lead to some kind of liberation. And getting back to queerness as well in terms of the community, I was reading Sophie K. Rose's book, Queer Intimacy. I don't know if you guys have read that yet.
I haven't read it all,
but it's really amazing. And she speaks about friendships and relationships as a potential for emancipation. The whole book is kind of about, like, we need to reframe our ideas about intimacy because, you know, the heteronormative kind of...
2.4 children.
Yeah. Like that doesn't serve us at all. And, you know, I think it's a conversation that I really love between, I can't remember their name. Anyway, this idea that, you know, we keep our family safe and you keep your family safe. And then we've got two safe families. And like in queerness, I think that there's this moment where we could have this intimacy and this romance that leads to some kind of emancipation. It doesn't mean that we have to all be, you know, in our tight monogamous relationships. Mm. Yeah.
Interesting.
You know, like I said, you know, when you first sort of fall in love with somebody or you start dating somebody, I spoke to a friend last night about it because I'm sort of starting to date somebody and I was just saying like how hard I find it. And it's not like a sexual thing. It's not kissing or anything like that. It's just like sitting on the sofa with a guy, holding their hand, walking to the beach, just doing really simple things. Even like, I don't know, sitting at home having breakfast together. I find that really hard. So much so it even made me cry. And then I told my friend the other day and they were saying, oh no, but it's such a wonderful thing falling in love. And I was like, yeah, but weirdly, I really struggle with it. And I like the person I'm dating and I'm going to keep dating them. But it's like, what is that about? And she said, maybe it's because when you were growing up, you felt like you couldn't have it. You know, because you were seeing your straight friends being able to hold hands at school when you were 10 or something or 13.
Yeah, and we weren't allowed.
And maybe you weren't able to in the 80s.
Well, we had Section 28, didn't we? We were just brainwashed that wasn't for us. And that was a choice that we were not, it was a choice that we were making and we were not allowed to make that.
But I found it quite powerful, this idea that those simple expressions, which should everyone should have a right to and, should experience,
basic intimacy,
a troublesome for me. It's like, it's mad.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm also dating somebody. I think it is definitely, you know, people who grew up with Section 28 and people who didn't. There's a big difference in how we move through the world in our visibly queer relationships. Like if I'm on the tube with my partner, I want to snog. And they're like,
What is the tube a big fetish for you then? You love the tube.
I love tube.
Many more films to come.
Oh, God, yeah. Like, you know, if we're in more public spaces, they struggle a bit more with intimacy and I guess PDA. Not intimacy, because I think that you can be intimate without, you know, snogging someone's face off.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and I realised that was because they're 6 years older than me and what they are used to or what they have, I guess, have been oppressed by is different to what I've been oppressed by as a queer person. So, I mean, I've definitely, you know, I fucking know that people are looking at me, but I guess it's the confidence that is different. And, you know, there's always potential for a hate crime or, you know, something that there's confidence.
But you feel allowed. There's a confidence, you're like, I'm allowed to take up this space. I'm Absolutely. Allowed to do what I'm doing now. Where there's, I think there is a certain generation, I think it's in us, in our core beliefs that we're not allowed. We don't have permission to exist how we want to exist. So we have to adapt and be how society is telling us is acceptable. If we are going to choose this, we have to be the acceptable mode of that.
There's also moments as well though, Rob, like where if that is the case, if you have realized that, then that's okay. What do you enjoy doing? And you can do that. You don't have to force yourself in.
Well, actually, I told him.
Yeah.
I actually told him, and I had tiny little tears in my eyes. And I said, I just have to tell you, I'm struggling
with
this.
That's so dramatic.
It was just like, it wasn't dramatic at the time.
Tiny
it was
little
just quite
tears.
Sad.
All right.
I know. Well, it's my way of delivering it. But anyway, I told him, and it's been really brilliant since, because I told him. And he actually took it as like being me being really vulnerable and being honest, and that honesty he then found really attractive. Yeah.
Hot.
So it's all worked out in the end. You know, talking about the tube made me think of Wolfgang Tillmann's photos of the tube where he took
the
pictures
armpit.
Of all his friends. Yeah, and the armpit. And there's the tube is an amazing location, actually. And Princess Julia, I think he put amazing pictures of her.
On the tube.
I love those. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Really cool.
It's an amazing space because it is constantly changing, which is, you know, quite, I mean, yeah, in that quick succession, it's almost like, I don't know, a brain with lots of thoughts.
So people come into your work, they would be right in thinking it's highly autobiographical.
Yes, I would say so. Yeah, definitely. I don't know how to do anything else, but also it's all I can do, as it keeps me alive, you know, in the same way that Tracy Emin says, you know, I honestly, if I'm not, the way that I move through my life is with this constant thing of, is what work can I make from this? I suppose it's like, there's always something that can come from any small moment, any small tear.
And a small tear coming from your eyes. It's do you walk around with a camera attached to you the whole time?
Yeah, most of the time. I mean, I obviously, it depends on where I am, but yeah, I've mostly, and that's only out of the cameras I have are for convenience, so that I can have them on me at all times. I don't really know much about the technological side of photography. It is just anything that I can use quickly that will look the way that I want it to look. So yeah, I do, but mostly, you know, I think that's where my writing comes into it, is when I don't have a camera, you know. So I write about what I'm seeing, and then maybe if there's a picture that says the same thing. I got asked the other day, because I have some pieces of text in the Martin Parr show, and I was asked why I showed the photos and the text next to each other, and I didn't really know. And then I realized that it's just different languages speaking the same about the same thing, you know, different languages within myself, which, yeah, I guess just gives it a more well-rounded conversation.
And if you think of your visual language, you said how I want it to look. How would you describe that, or what is it you are looking for?
I think it's not necessarily what I'm looking for, but what's looking at me mostly. And I was thinking the other day about, again, Ajami was saying, you know, we should create images that we want to see. And I was like, this is absolutely true. But there's a lot of images in my work, especially ones of Britishness, especially ones of, like, you know, Union Jacks and stuff like that. They're not necessarily images that I want to see, but they're images that are shown to me already. So I think that, you know, I always say, even though I can't be there physically to explain things to people, I always want to remind them that in my photography, I'm the one looking first. I'm the one whose gaze you should be looking through at everything. Because then I think that brings into it, like, is this an image that I want to see, or is it not an image that I want to see? You know, there's this constant back and forth, and showing those images together, I think I enjoy, and it makes me understand my own position, because it is that kind of being privileged in your unprivilegedness, you know, recognizing where the location of all of this queer energy is, and that location might not be safe, and it might not be welcoming, and it might be violent, and it might be othering, and it might be all of this stuff, but then there is this gorgeous thing that happens in between, the rudeness, you know. So I like to do both, and so yeah, having a camera on me at all times is important, but definitely certain places and locations I am more sure to have one with me.
I really feel the energy of Nan Goldin through your practice. One of her titles of one of her books is Let Me Be Your Mirror, and you talking about how you want people to see the work through your lens and how we see Nan Goldin's world and how she captures her friends and family, and it's so autobiographical, and her photography is her diary. And I feel like you really, is she someone you look to, and do you feel like your work is your diary?
Yeah, I would say so. But not only mine, it's, you know, the people that I love. That's my goal, to have this archive and evidence of the people that I love. And I think that Nan's work is amazing, and you recognize that she is present. You are looking through her gaze. You're very aware of that when you look at the images, because of the love that she has for the people yes. that she's photographing. And I'd never, ever photograph people or places that I'm not familiar with or that I don't have some kind of relationship with emotionally for that reason.
So you wouldn't do commissions like a...
Well, not really. So that's with the Martin Park was a commission. And Martin really wanted me to take photos in Bristol because that's where the foundation is. And I was like, no, I cannot do that. I've never been to Bristol. I don't know what that is. And Martin has been amazing. And he was like, you can do this. There's a way that you can do this. And he drove me around in his car one day in Bristol. And he had like mobility issues at the time, so he couldn't walk around with me, but he would just stop his car and say, walk around this place. That road. And then I was like, okay, Martin Parr, or so I did that, and I looked at St. Paul's and, you know, the places where there's more of a Caribbean presence. And I was just like, but I'm still a voyeur here, and it just is not, it's sticky, it's too... Yeah, the voyeurism is too loud, and I wouldn't do anything justice. So when I remembered that Travis was from Bristol and had moved back to Bristol in lockdown, I was like, okay, here's my love, you know, here it is. And so I decided to do the whole show on Travis, and it's been a wonderful, wonderful experience.
I've got a voice note from Travis here I can play. Well,
yeah, so this is Travis Alabanza.
Have they already done the voice note? Oh, my God.
Writer, playwright, performer, has just actually acted with Russell in a Derek Jarman Blue Now.
We perform that together. Okay, so I'm going to play this in.
Hi, I'm Travis Alabanza. I'm a writer and a performer, and Rini has made me their subject. I guess me and Rini have known each other or been in the same orbit because we were both like... Well, we're still young in it, but like we're both even younger queer artists of colour that were kind of coming up in a scene at the time where lots of different collectives and people were in conversations with each other or knew each other's work. So even though I don't really make work in gallery spaces, like we were connecting and I guess inspired and looking at each other's work for a long time and would be friends in the club and bump into each other through mutuals. And what's really nice is that like, we've been pals in that kind of way for a while, and Rini wanted to do something where it brought us closer together. And so I asked to take photos of me, but the issue is that I said, babes, all I do is stay at home when I'm not at work and just go to the pub with my mates. And Rini was like, well, we'll come and take pics of that. And it's really nice to have that side of my life documented rather than like all the stage photos. Even if it is hard to be on camera without a really good makeup artist, but there you go. Yeah, it was quite weird having to be the subject and not like in charge. I find it really hard to like let go of that kind of thing. It was just quite vulnerable. Like we went back to where I grew up and like to the different areas and stuff of Bristol. I grew up on a council estate that I don't live in Bristol anymore. And it was quite interesting that I hadn't processed a lot of things about going up there that then kind of came out in the wash by showing someone else around. But it was really lovely, and it was kind of gorgeous days out and hopefully like the start of like long-term collaboration, which was nice. And I think that's what's amazing about Rini's work is like it feels like archiving rather than forced photos. So it kind of was just hanging out, and then the photos are like a reminder of that hanging out.
So that was Travis talking about an exhibition you have coming up titled A Girl for the Living Room.
Yes. Yeah, and everything that they say I echo as well. It was, yeah, again, not something, you know, I was hugely anxious when I made the film about my dad, just focusing on one subject and actually asking that vulnerability from somebody, because I'm used to asking it of myself. I know how to deal with myself. I can do all of that. But asking it of someone else's It's a big deal. And so I was very grateful that they said yes. But yeah, it was, the plan was to get to know each other, you know, and that's all. And get to know each other outside of the dance floor, which is where a lot of queer trans people of colour meet. And actually relationships kind of sometimes only just exist in that dance floor, and that's beautiful and that's enough. But I think post-lockdown, a lot of those relationships felt really far away. And I was like, a lot of actually quite a few people that I had met in the club, I kind of pulled our relationships out, which I was very grateful for. And I hadn't done that with Travis. And so I thought, let's do this in this time. We're both a similar age, similar, as we've been getting to know, similar gender, even similar queerness, similar everything. And so, yeah, the goal was to just see what love looks like outside and outside of the dance floor on purpose. You know, I keep coming back to the word intentional when I'm talking about the show. I guess maybe the first work that I've made involving photography that has been on purpose and for a reason other than it just being in the moment. Obviously, the whole thing has been in the moment and gorgeous and kind of spontaneous, but I knew the whole time and they knew the whole time that we were creating something together.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
You know.
And there's an amazing quote that's in the text that accompanies the forthcoming exhibition, which said, "You're developing relationship as it became lit by a table lamp instead of a disco ball." And I thought that was just such a great line. I mean, that's like a poem in itself.
Yeah, I mean, it is part of a poem that I wrote for the show, so that was quoted in the text. But I think I've just been interested in, I've always been interested in the dance floor and dance spaces. And especially in terms of subculture and what they produce and what they can be and have been for queer people and working class people and to people of different races. But that is imaged quite a lot, especially with Black trans people. It's almost as if you exist as a performance, as a dancer, as a, you know, someone to give constantly. And that is amazing, and those, we feel celebrated in those spaces and we're imaged as celebrating, but it's like there's a tiredness. And I've been thinking a lot and wondering about if photographing a body is an opportunity for that body to rest. I don't know, but there's something in taking the relationship outside, like onto the streets, onto into the living room, into a domestic space that is quiet and a space of rest. I don't think that those images exist very much at the moment, I would say, in what we're seeing of queerness in the media and stuff like that. But yeah, I've also, I've been reading a book called There's a Disco Ball Between Us by Jafari S. Allen. I don't know if that's how you pronounce their name, but they talk about the disco ball as this amazing thing that is, you know, you were saying about, who was it that wrote the book about mirrors? What did you say?
Nan Goldin, Let Me Be Your Mirror.
Oh yeah, Nan Goldin, Let Me Be Your Mirror. But the disco ball is multiple mirrors, and that's such a blessing for us. And that moves away from this fixedness that I'm unhappy with. And it moves, It means that even with a disco ball and with lights hitting a disco ball.
So fragmented, isn't it? That's almost a metaphor for the people that are enjoying the music, enjoying the lights.
Absolutely. There's many mirrors to that, and there's many opportunities and a limitlessness that we are granted that is, you know, the most precious thing and the thing that we're asking for. That's all we're ever asking for in terms of, you know, liberation, just to be granted the multitudes of the self. And so I absolutely love the dance place and the disco ball and all of that. But there's also, what if we take mirrors away and we are just by ourselves? You know, I can't come away from that, unfortunately, because I am there with a camera. And, you know, when a camera is present, there's always, there's not really a loneliness ever when a camera is present. But I just wanted to explore that a bit further and see if we can still have a moment of celebration outside of the moments of performance, I suppose.
How long did it take? Were you together for a weekend or did you do it?
We've just done because of Travis's schedule is mad because they're so booked and busy as they should be.
Booked and blessed, yeah.
Yeah, but basically I think I approached them in 2022, started off seeing them without asking them if they could be present. I would kind of come to wherever they were, like a book signing or something like that, and I guess just start feeling it out. And also just to, we didn't know each other that well, so just to be in each other's orbit a bit more. And that was 2022, and then most of the pictures are 2023, where we've hung out probably about 5 times in different occasions, different locations between London and Bristol when we could. And when, Travis, I guess when Travis was ready, ready, because it was a vulnerable, experience for both of us.
You work on digital film, right?
No, 35mm.
Oh, you do? Oh, wow. Yeah. And how many images are in the exhibition? Do you know?
Oh, my God, I actually don't know. I think like 20... maybe like 28, I think. I'm not sure though. But obviously there was a lot to choose from because they do give. And that's the thing about someone like Travis is they perform for work, but they give. And I suppose that's why they like spending time at home. And, you know, I will never be able to infiltrate that moment for them on purpose, because that is them alone in their space to not be witnessed, you know? So there's, I guess it's more of an in-between stage. It's not Travis, you know, relaxing completely, but it's not Travis having to kiki the house down, you know, for a gaze.
And there's definitely a tenderness in the photos, I think, which is different to a kind of connection you might have in a club environment. I imagine there's something about the table lamp, as you described it, that just creates this different atmosphere. And it did remind me of some of the work in the Tate collection now. Congratulations. Wonderful.
It's at the Tate Britain, the new rehang. It's amazing. It's very
wrong. Oh, yeah. You can actually see it at Tate Britain. But there's one in particular, a mutual friend of ours, Chidera Egaru. So it's called Chidi Doing Rini's Hair from 2019. So that's another one of those sort of... There was a show recently in Margate at the gallery called To Be Held, curated by Rona McKenzie, and it included an artist, I think it's from Bristol actually, called Naomi Williams. And these were like domestic photos of her with her sister in the domestic situation where they're sharing space. I think they're called shared spaces, and one of them's reading like Queenie the book and the other's learning to play the flute on the bed. They're these really beautiful, tender portraits, and they really made me think about the tenderness in your work. Oh, the other way around, like when I saw their work, it made me think they should look at you, because I already knew you. But can you talk a bit about that as well, and like Chidera?
Yeah, I mean, Chidi and I have been friends for a very long time, and we have a really special relationship, one of care, I think, mostly, and care and love. And we actually spent a lot of time together privately in my flat, or their flat or her flat. And it's been just a beautiful relationship. And her doing my hair was, I think Maggie took that. And it was just one of our evenings together where we were just I would probably cook or something. And Chidera loves my dogs. So mostly Chidera would just come round and dance with the dogs in the mirror and not talk to me. But that kind of moment of, especially for Chidera as well, he has quite a high following and is being watched constantly, to see, her be still. Or not still, because that's also something that is confusing to me. I'm also, just to ask you guys, what do you think a body can rest in an image?
Yeah, I don't know actually, because
it's everything, isn't it? Like acting or you know, dance or anything that's filmed. If you have a camera present, the trick is that you forget about it, so you can be in that moment, but you never do, because you're aware of angles, you're aware of being captured, being heard, being seen. There are all these things. I guess if you set up a Big Brother situation where you just put the cameras in the house and left, and then you had like CCTV monitoring, maybe you might be able to capture it then. But even so, unless if the subject knew that, they would still also have an edit.
But even if they were sleeping and conscious, they're still going to be moving.
I remember that David Beckham, Sam Taylor Wood, where he was sleeping and everybody went to see it. Yeah.
What it might do is photography can make the viewer still, because I feel like with photographs, I often stop dead and then your brain is whirring, but your actual physicality, you can be quite still. Stillness is such an interesting
It
idea.
Is in terms of, yeah, any, like, is it even possible? It's kind of, it's not really, is it even
it's very
a thing?
Private, isn't it, stillness?
Yeah,
it's so private,
and it's on so many different levels, because as you say, you can stop still, but your brain is moving. But I think that the thing for me is, I need to reframe that and think more about it. But there's, with people that I'm photographing, especially now that they know me more as a photographer, there's an awareness of the self constantly. So Chidera doing my hair and us having that moment of tenderness, both of us have an awareness that that moment means something, because it means something to us, and therefore for are happy for that to be frozen in a moment. And I think that it's the same with the Travis collaboration. Travis has a huge awareness of themselves, and that's why they knew what we were doing and why we should be doing it. And anyone that I take pictures of, there's an awareness. But mainly that's where the love comes in. We have a mutual awareness of each other, and that I think is what I try and show.
How do all the people in your photographs feel about being on gallery walls? And as you get more successful, and now you're in the Tate collection, and they're being seen by so many people. And Travis, for example, obviously is a performer, so they are probably a lot more comfortable with that. But some of the people you're photographing are not performers. They're people that are in your life, and now they're in a public arena, and they're only going to get more and more seen. Some of these photos are incredibly iconic of Maggie in the cafe, and Maggie with different colour hair through different processes. I mean, these photos, like Nangoldian subjects, will end up becoming like images that are just burned into the retinas of all of us. How do they feel about that? Is everyone collectively supportive, or is there sort of a slight friction at times now as it's going bigger?
I'm not really sure, to be honest. I think you'd have to ask them, but there's definitely people who I have, I guess, more of an archive with, that are more aware of what's going on and know where they're going to end up. And I guess we consent, they consent, everybody consents. Maggie is an amazing figure in the work, because that series that Tate have is from Flags for Countries That Don't Exist But Bodies That Do. And Maggie kind of punctuates the time with different hair, different outfits, different moods. And that's an amazing archive of a life and a love between us. And I think that everybody knows that this is, obviously, I show my love in lots of different ways, but this is a huge way that I show my love to them. And I guess an appreciation and a thank you, you know, it really is like a thank you for this, all of this. Thank you for giving me these images in between the ones that I don't want to see.
I feel like that's why I connect with your work, though. I think it's really about human connection, humanity, and not just love, but this tenderness that I mentioned before, but maybe also just connection and a kind of document of a life, you know, in a really honest, beautifully open, raw way, actually.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I hope so. It's, you know, I when I started taking photos, I really had no idea what I was doing until the images come back to me, which is why I like working on 35 millimeter, because there's a gap between the moment and then when I see that moment again. And I never really know what is going on. I guess that's why I take pictures. Maybe I'm not actually that present in the moment because I'm always thinking about other things. Maybe that's my way of remembering, you know.
Do you think there's a role as a curator somehow? Like once you get these images, that somehow it becomes like collaging something together in terms of an exhibition? You know, I know you're the artist, but as the artist, you are also curating this world, this memory,
the narrative,
trying to make sense of your life.
Absolutely, yeah. Like when I'm installing photography, there was South London Gallery when we had the one room of the flag series. And then the other day when I was in Bristol installing the Martin Parr show, I need to be by myself and it takes me a really long time. I always think, you know, I had image prints out of all of the Travis photos on this wall and I was moving them around and I thought that I'd figured it out and they were tiny, but then when I saw them printed and framed, I was like, the conversations between these images can be different depending on where they are and in the room, you know, and with each other and who's next to who. And so then it took me about 2 hours to figure out before anything goes on the wall who's talking to who in these photos. And I've noticed a lot within my work there's always things come in pairs. The Quench show was very much that. There was a pair of coats, a pair of chairs, a pair of notes next to each other, and it always seems that the relationships that I'm having with these people come through even in the way that I install them. So there always is a conversation between two people happening in the space, I suppose, which is like what happened when I'm taking the pictures.
And actually the Quench show, it was a really interesting installation because it actually had kind of everyday objects like coats.
Yeah.
And even like, were they hair braids or something?
Oh, that was it. My brother's and mine's baby blankets.
Baby blankets. Okay.
Yeah, they were all knotted up. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, there's always, those works were called Reserve for Zach and Rini because my brother's called Zach. And that was giving a moment of reservation for a conversation to happen. The chairs were called Reserve for Mum and Dad. You know, it's this constant thing of maybe imagined conversations that actually I think I have mostly between myself that maybe I wish that I'm trying to have when I take photos, and maybe it's not verbalized, but it's communicated in another way.
Do you have a dark room? Do you have somewhere you process the photos?
No, I don't. I get them sent off, but I'm learning soon how to do that because, again, speaking to Ajami, they were talking about this idea of pleasure within the work, that they prioritize pleasure, you know, and that's, I guess, what I'm always trying to do. And they prioritize pleasure through their whole practice. So from start to finish being, I think they say that photography prioritizes the visual, and for them to get a full experience, a sensual experience, the dark room becomes, you know, the smells and the touch and everything like that. So they're
the chemicals and
which
poppers.
Is,
I think Ajama said they reminded me of poppers.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. which is, there's a photo of Travis and I doing poppers in my show, actually.
Excellent. I love that.
And, you know, so I'm interested in that as a full working practice in photography. I guess I have pleasure from start to finish because I'm, you know, surrounded by people and having a nice time and living my life, I suppose, but also not having a nice time sometimes. So there isn't pleasure really in every aspect of the work, but it's about ending up in pleasure and the goal being pleasure. So I would really, Ajami said that I should go and learn how to, at least if I don't use it.
Amazing. Yeah, of course.
You know, like I read a quote yesterday via Nadia from Pussy Riot, because we spoke to her last week and I've been chatting to her a bit. And there's this Felix Gonzalez Torres quote that said, aesthetics is politics. The problem with political art is that it had a look which was too easy to dismiss. We should rescue beauty and pleasure, repossess beauty for our own ends and reinterpret it for our own purposes. And I thought that was such a beautiful statement, and what a great artist he was anyway. But like this idea that, you know, that beauty and pleasure can be sort of reclaimed or something.
Absolutely. And yeah,
by queerness.
Felix Gonzalez Torres as well, you know, was one of the first artists that I saw when I was younger that I was like, okay, like, because of the delicacy of the work and the beauty, immediately you see beauty, you know, before you even recognize what it's about. And then it kind of, it kind of, yeah, has the potential to punch you in the fucking face, you know? And that is, I think, a real goal of mine to, yeah, I don't know. Obviously there's a lot of conversation. It's in terms of what, how good is representation? What is representation? What do we need from it and what can it give us? And I think that I'm always a bit wary that my work is maybe too nice, too good to look at, too pleasant on the eye. And I think I speak about that in the Brown Girl in the Art World, you know, that the image of me dancing is really easy to look at because it looks, it's lovely, you know, it is beautiful. But then I guess with the audio, I'm drawing attention to the fact that, yeah, this is beautiful, but there's tension. And I think that with, yeah, any of my photos or any of the other work that I make, I'm always trying to, there's a luring in that I think is bless that you can do with beauty. And yeah, I don't know. What do you think about it?
I think what you said is brilliant.
Okay.
I always want to ask about like how you are finding, how you're coping with success. Like we've just said, you're in the new Tate Britain rehang, you're in the National Collection, you've got this great exhibition opening up at the Martin Parr space, and Martin Parr, a photographer who's well known for his constant exploration of what Britishness is. And big shout out to Roja Farkas, who runs Arcadia Missa. We love
yes,
Roja. She's just the best gallerist, best gallery.
She's actually a previous
guest
on Talk
that's
Art.
Right.
So if you look in the archive way back, I think in the pandemic or something,
And
one of our really early guests.
And she's obviously doing an incredible job of you, and she's so proud of all of her artists and so proud of you. What does, how are you coping with that? And what are your ambitions going forwards? Are there like, are there dreams? Is there an international representation thing on the horizon?
Yeah, I mean, Roja, I met Roja at when I was protesting the Luke Willis Thompson Turner Prize nomination with Babes, which was a dance and art DJ collective that doesn't exist anymore. But I had written an essay for Galden about my uncomfortability with Luke Willis Thompson's nomination. And then Babes decided, because Babes got asked to DJ the Turner Prize, we had an in. So it was a quiet protest. We just wore t-shirts that said Black Pain is not for profit. And it was the same time that Jessie Darling's Art Now was opening. So Roja was in the Art Now space and I was speaking to Jessie, and Roja came over and I was like, who are you? And then I got asked to write for, oh, I think they put the essay in How to Sleep Faster, which is the Arcadia Missa publication that they do. And then from them, our relationship started. But I was, I think, 21, maybe. I've always been a baby. I'm still a baby now. I've just turned 26. But we've had a relationship from a long time where she's been aware of maybe potential, you know, my potential and where I could go, but mainly the help that I needed to get there as, especially as a marginalized person, you know. She has just been absolutely incredible. And when I graduated in lockdown, I didn't have a degree show. And the film that I had made for my degree show, which was In the Quench Show, Roja put it on the Arcadia Missa website as a, like a solo presentation. And I think that that was really, you know, where I realized that the professional relationship was just as beautiful as, you know, the friendship relationship. But yeah, so she's absolutely done wonders for me. And I think we just make a good team. You know, it really is about the people that you're surrounded by. I would not be as confident in myself and my work if it wasn't for Rose. She was the first one to tell me that my photos was artworks in the first place. And we did the book together of series one of Flags. And then we did a show in 2022, was it? Yeah. And that's when things started popping off, you know, and I was like, wow, okay, this is really what I always wanted. This is the beginning of it now. And everything that happens to me so far still feels like the beginning, because it is. I'm 26, I'm very new, but a lot of goals have already been reached, being put in the Tate collection. They bought the work 3 years ago or 2 years ago.
From Frieze, wasn't it?
From Frieze, yeah. Yeah. But then, you know, which is incredible in itself, but then never would I imagine that they would hang it, you know, this soon. I think I'm the youngest person in the Tate collection. I've just changed my bio on Instagram to the youngest artist in the world. That's why I told. But I'm constantly reminded by all of my peers and everybody, you know, Arcadia Missa and everybody that know and loves me, that I am very young. And, you know, I'm also aware of that myself, and I have felt the pressure immensely, especially when Tate bought the work. I think it was a moment where I realised that rest was not going to come for a long time, and I've got to continue to make, which I would anyway, but continue to make the work that I make, but now with more eyes on me and therefore pressure, you know.
But also do remember to carve out rest, because actually that's one of the most important things as well, because otherwise you won't be able to do everything else with as much vigor. Can I ask you, being in your 20s, I think 20s are often a time when you are becoming an adult, and then through your 20s you sort of start to really deal with a lot of the traumas from growing up, or just like, you know, thinking about your, if you've moved location, so you're now in London, but I know you grew up in Peterborough, and your show at South London Gallery was from a kind of local phrase, upon this rock, and I really liked it because of that foundation stone element, this idea that like Peterborough is your kind of DNA in a way, you know, it kind of brought you up. Can you speak a bit about your relationship with Peterborough and how you feel about it?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think, yeah, I mean, I'm exhausted by my 20s because of how much work I'm doing and how much I'm learning and growing constantly. And Peterborough was a place where I didn't feel like I could do that, which is why I left. I think that leaving is a really good thing to do. But I return back there more and more in a conceptual sense and in a physical sense as well. I need to go see my mum and dad and brothers and family. But I used to really be, I guess, jaded by the fact that I was brought up in this small city and living in the suburbs. And then as I moved to London, I realised how much that has fed who I am as a person. And I guess, a kind of thankfulness was present in the show that I did at South London Gallery for Peterborough and for the smallness of it. And I say in the talk with Emma Dabbery how grateful I am now for boredom and what that's done for me.
You said boredom is sick.
Yeah, boredom is sick. What that's done for me as an artist, I think that's why my brain doesn't rest on anything, because I'm constantly entertaining myself, you know, and I think that I learned how to do that in Peterborough. And so, yeah, it's a beautiful thing. And
but also that element of community. I love the idea that you had like an auntie who would just drive up unannounced, uninvited, just knock on the door and be like, hey, and those moments. But that's almost like what all of us like busy creative people need to remember, to rest, but also to have community and loving friendships where there is no purpose. You can't just have
chosen family.
Like my friend Nadira Amrani, the director, came around today, literally had a tea for 15 minutes and then left. And it was amazing. I loved it. There was zero. It was just like popping in. Loved
all
that.
Of my friends and I, it's actually been amazing living in Dalston. I've literally recently just moved, but there's a lot of people in my vicinity. And so popping in it's possible now. I don't think it's been that possible In London, I don't know, maybe we're lazy or maybe there's just a lot going on and people, you know, getting on a tube doesn't feel like the most natural thing to go and have a 15-minute cup of tea. But I really crave that so much. And I crave that in my queerness, I think. And it's, I'm really, honestly, in the past few months, I'm really gaining that back and seeing friends for, you know, before I think I would, you know, I'd make dinner. I'd love hosting and I'd love having the dolls round, but we'd make dinner and then we get pissed and stay up till 1 a.m. And, you know, that's fucking great. I love doing that. You know, that is the best. But it means that you only do that every so often because you do a big catch up. And so I'm enjoying knowing people, really knowing them. And not having to get to know them actually anymore, just knowing them from when they walk in the door for however long it is that they're here, and them not having to explain themselves or why they feel the way that they do, because I already know because I saw them 2 days ago. You know, that is a huge power in queerness, because there's a big opportunity for care that I think has been lacking in my life anyway for the past few years.
Yeah. Aren't we lucky that we do have that? I feel like that of all my friends, apart from Rob. I just feel so.
I would say the same about you.
You're so rude.
No, but also the unconditional, isn't it? I think, and the subtlety of it all. And I think as queer people, we're often made like through force of like the world being against you for existing, to have armor, to be strong, to be tough. Mm-hmm.
And there's a queerness in the reason why we need to be with each other for however many periods of time it is, because there is knowing that there is a safety in these friendships.
And community,
And community. And like in my photos, you know, you can tell the people, the periods of time where I've had that with people, you know, because it comes and goes. People move on, people live their lives, people get busier, people get quieter, and people need to protect their peace. But, you know, Chidera lived round the corner from me when I lived in that flat that the picture was taken in, and Chidera is present in a certain year, you know, and then someone else is present in another year. And it's also about the different levels of care that friends need to receive. The more I'm around someone, it normally means that we are maybe keeping each other alive a bit more than we normally need to, you know.
Yeah, we're helping each other heal even just from like the everyday. Can I, before we move on to our final questions, can I ask you quickly, you know, with Peterborough in mind, I know there's this amazing vitrine that you showed, which has the kind of football scarf within it. How important is that kind of like found object vitrine thing? I think you showed it in Kunstverein Gartenhaus in Vienna.
I collect constantly. My studio is really mostly a storage place for weird things that I like the look of, that I don't maybe understand why I like the look of or why I need to have them. So a football scarf, a t-shirt, a pair of jeans, a pair of Doc Martens, you know, a lot of the stuff comes from my obsession with subculture and signifiers of subculture and signifiers of identity. And I think that if I ever do get a chance to show them, I mean, normally they come, it's not mostly research for me. So looking at a thing, feeling a thing, and also wearing a thing has been a kind of performance, I suppose. But yeah, I think I realized with the SLG show that I was like, these things deserve to speak for themselves rather than me speak on behalf of them. And that was photos, family photos that I found, some of them in the frames that I had, you know, taken off the shelves literally without asking my mum. and newspapers, old documents that I'd just been, you know, that I'd come across or been given by loved ones and things like that, that do pile up in my studio that I don't really get a chance to really absorb. And that was a really nice moment of also surrounding myself with Peterborough when I'm not there, you know. I wouldn't say that I miss it. I miss family and I miss friends, but maybe I think it's mostly the reminiscing aspect. But I reminisce from a time before myself as well, which is where most of them, the objects come from, is a time before I was around. And I like to have objects around me that, I guess, bring me into the space with them.
How the past manifests into the future.
Yeah, exactly. I've spoken about that before. That's a big part of yeah, a lot of the work that I do, because the photographs are very current, you know, they're very up to date almost. But a lot of the work that I do is very much based around or from, you know, post-war Britain, and all of the research that I do is on that. And all of the, I'm not very good at reading, as I've said, but academia is very helpful if I can get my head around it. But the ways in which I think come from that, and I think that the ways in which I take photos stem from an obsession with the past.
Amazing.
Yeah.
We're going to get into our final questions now.
I love you.
I love you.
Obsessed.
And you know what? Just keep being yourself, because it's just the best.
Honestly, obsessed. You light up my whole world every time I see you. I need to come and see you in Margate. And Russ,
just Rob. Is that
Russ, you exist.
Russ gets so competitive, right? See? It's a Scorpio.
I'm going to light up your life as well. It's coming.
You already have, thank you. Are you halfway down? I don't know. When am I going to see you guys in real life, ever?
IRL or away from keyboard. Very soon. Okay. If you could do an art heist, Rini, you can steal any work of art in the world for yourself, what would it be and why?
Oh, my Lord. Dude. That is such a hard question.
You knew it was coming, right?
I didn't prepare. I went out last night. it might be Felix Gonzalez Torres clocks, actually.
Perfect Lovers.
Yeah. Mm. I think that for me, it's been actually, especially in recent times, I've been going through a very big breakup, and that work was quite present in the beginning of the relationship that I had with Maggie. Hi, shout out Maggie, love you so much. and that idea that you can have these relationships or these moments that start together and can maybe go out of time or come back together is incredibly important in my journey in keeping the love that Maggie and I have for each other, you know, as big as it can be. And so I would say that that's the work that I would steal, and I would definitely give it to Maggie.
Oh, well, this is, for everyone listening, this is two clocks that, it's two lovers or perfect lovers, and they are at the exact same time, but it doesn't make any sense, but sometimes they fall out of time. Even though it's the same time, they've got the same, they're exactly the same clock, but there's something so beautiful about that Felix Gonzalez Torres has found, and it's so simple. They're falling out of sync, but yet it should be in sync, because we're just, that's what time is. It doesn't falter, it is what it is, but these clocks do.
And I think that comes back to this idea of the unsanitized queerness as well, the allowance that things are not perfect and we cannot be perfect at all times. There's so much against us. I actually have a show. I have a show at Chapter Gallery coming up in October in New York. It's my first.
Oh, great.
Yeah, really excited about that. And that is going to be about relationships, especially romantic ones, queer ones, with a focus on Maggie and I, actually. We're kind of working together on talking about it, but also just recognizing that a lot of it wasn't our fault as an intersectional couple that have lots of things against us in the world, to love in that and to move with grace through this world and to move with grace in sync is such a hard thing to do. Mm. And so we want to speak more about how we managed to do that and how we're going to continue to do that in some kind of capacity.
Amazing. Well, that's a great gallery. Cheyenne Julian is I'm a big fan of Cheyenne's work. And is it Nicole Russo?
Yeah, Nicole. Yeah. Amazing.
Great eye. Yeah, brilliant. Oh, congratulations for that. That's very exciting.
Thank you.
And the other question we ask every guest is, what is your favourite colour?
My favourite colour at the moment is fluorescent beige.
Yes! I'm actually going to write that down. I want that on the T-shirt. What is the best advice you've ever received when it comes to your work?
Maybe what Adami was saying the other day about pleasure, you know? Pleasure from start to finish, I think, is important. Because I do work so autobiographically. I don't know, I've had lots of moments where the work has become a lot because of reading things, trying to understand trauma while making work about, you know, all of these different things and blah, 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 blah. It's a lot. It's like having therapy every day constantly. I am also in therapy. which has been a savior. But yeah, in remembering that pleasure is the goal, I would say is the best advice.
All right, well, let everyone listen to that. Pleasure is the goal. This has been incredible. Thank you so much. Your show at the Martin Parr Foundation in Bristol, Girl for the Living Room, opens when, Robert? You know the dates normally.
It opens on the 13th of July and it runs for a long time, luckily, until the 17th of September. Oh, so you've got all summer to get to Bristol and see it. And it's at the Martin Parr Foundation. You can go to martinparrfoundation.org. And also go to renematic.com and Arcadia Missa. We'll also connect with them. We love them. And you can also see Rini, I think, on Instagram.
Yes, Rini.matic. And yeah, come say hey.
Thank you so much for speaking with us. You're just the best.
It's been heaven. Thank you.
So much love for you. And we'll be back very soon. Thanks for listening, everybody. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.